And this is an interview with R. Victor Jones, conducted by David Brock by telephone on April the 18th, 2006. And Professor Jones, as I mentioned, I thought we could begin with a little bit of your personal background. In digging around, I did see that you got both your undergraduate degree and your doctoral degree in physics from UC Berkeley. Are you a native Californian?
Yeah, I grew up in Oakland, so Berkeley was a great opportunity for me.
And may I ask you a little bit about your family background, your father's vocation, and the development of your earliest interests in science or technical subjects?
Yeah, my parents were Welsh immigrants, and they had come here in their 20s. Individually, had come to the United States in the 20s and had met here and married. And my father was a machinist, mm-hmm. I hope I learned some mechanical skills from him, which I have found useful over a lifetime. I had always considered myself an experimental physicist, and I do feel there was some resonance there.
Did you was building your own equipment a large part of your experimental career?
Yeah, I always enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that figures in some sense into the shock experience.
Right. Did you attend did you go through the public education system in Oakland?
Yeah, I went to High School in Oakland, and then went on to Berkeley. I started in 1947, which was Berkeley was receiving the huge input of veterans, and it was the most crowded year I think Berkeley had ever experienced. And you know, chemistry laboratories were held in the wee hours of the morning and so forth. It was an interesting experience.
In your high school experience, could you speak to the development of your interest in science in general, physics in particular, and how that may or may not have related to any of your hobbies outside of school?
I think it goes the other way. When I was very young, I always read physics extensively. I was very interested in stories about evolving atomic and nuclear physics. Read lots of popular books on the subject when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to high school, I went kind of a different route. I was sort of active in political affairs. I was high school student body president at the high school, and I was very active in dramatics. And I viewed myself for a long time as a potential actor.
Hmm.
So that was sort of the chief interest in high school was going off in these other directions. Physics was pretty easy for me, well, especially in American high school, it was very demanding, and I used to not go to physics classes and rip off the exams and stuff like that. it was a kind of a loose discipline kind of situation through high school. That changed in college. I got very interested in physics in college and worked quite hard at it. I had done some peculiar things, and as a youngster, I had sort of built a lot of electronics on my own. My biggest project, I think, as a youngster, was building a sort of a oscilloscope from the ground up. And
wow.
I did learn a fair bit of electronics in the process of doing that. I also got a lot of shocks.
Was amateur radio, did that
no.
figure at all?
No, it wasn't.
Yeah. Did sort of war surplus vacuum tubes aid you in
that,
any of those?
That was a great help. I became familiar with the old battery of burgeoning electronics. electronics. I was basically growing up during World War II and just missed. And so I was, you know, I was aware of evolving electronic technology.
Right.
As well as many other things. But I was definitely not a science wonk in high school. I mean, I was very much interested in other things.
Hmm. What would you point to that really reoriented you back to physics in your undergraduate days?
That's actually an interesting question, and I'm not even sure I know the answer to it. I sort of went to college on a lark, actually, because I was actually thinking about doing other things, and I think that it was taking some of the early physics courses in college and doing pretty well at them sort of, you know, catalyzed my interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly didn't go expecting that I was going to be very successful at it, and it was a peculiar time for physics, because physics had been very successful as a wartime entity, obviously. I remember by the time I graduated, it was not a good thing to get a job. I mean, I actually went through the program for elementary teachers. I mean, you know, went through the teacher training program just to make sure I could get a job when I got out. That did change by the time I graduated my PhD.
Did you have an opportunity to do research as an undergraduate?
Yes, I did. I worked with Walter Knight, and he was doing nuclear magnetic resonance in metals, and I built some apparatus for him and things like that. It was a good experience. It was a very good experience.
That's quite early, isn't it, into the nuclear magnetic resonance game?
Well, yeah, it was early, and the fellow I did my PhD with was one of Felix Bloch's students at Stanford, and so it was an early part of the nuclear magnetic resonance, or the resonance business in general.
I see.
Walter Knight was a very good experimental physicist. He eventually became provost at Berkeley, and he's a good man.
Was he something of a mentor to you as an undergraduate?
I would say somewhat. I would say he certainly sort of helped me to define an experimental mode to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But not strongly. I wouldn't say it was a strong mentorship. But I think the most useful thing is that Berkeley at that point was a very hot place, and it sort of got me in touch with lots of people doing research and picked up the excitement of doing research.
Mm-hmm.
It was more the sort of sociology of the research that I learned.
The excitement and the process.
Yep.
Would you speak to your decision to pursue the PhD at Berkeley?
Well, that's an interesting. I had never intended to go on for graduate work, but as I said, this was 1951, 52, and the economy was in pretty bad shape. Top graduates from Berkeley in electrical engineering were installing TV sets. I mean, it was not a time of great opportunity. And the point was, I was enjoying physics a lot, and it just seemed like a sort of holding pattern to go on to do research. With the Korean War, the sort of interest in electronics and physics and so forth picked up very considerably.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was a fairly passive decision to do that, and it was easy. I had done fairly well as an undergraduate, and certainly Berkeley was perfectly happy to have me, and so it was somewhat a passive decision.
Would you describe the process that you went through to pick someone to work with?
I think I basically Berkeley was dominated by the cyclotron lab, Lawrence lab, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Big physics, and I think I always gravitated away from big physics in the sense that I really liked, and this goes back to the Walter Knight experience. I enjoyed doing experiments, but I also enjoyed doing experiments where you were also the theorist, that you interpret your own experiments.
Mm-hmm.
So small physics was always attractive to me in the sense that I've also always enjoyed theory, and in small physics you tend to be your own theorist, and so I think it was that aspect of it that sort of set me on the direction of not going the big physics route,
mm-hmm.
which was sort of the dominant pattern at Berkeley.
And who was it that you eventually
decided? I went to work for Carson Jeffries,
who was
quite a remarkable man, actually. Carson Jeffries, again, was an extraordinarily good experimentalist, and I think I was his second student. He was putting together. He wasn't tenured when I started with him.
Okay.
And he was putting together a small group of people working in experimental physics. His first student was a Japanese American student who had just gotten back from fighting in Italy, and he did a project in nuclear magnetic resonance, and I started Jeffrey's work in electron magnetic resonance. So it was, we were really sort of starting his group. I mean, we built a lot of equipment from scratch, and that was a good experience. I always enjoyed that. In some ways, looking back on it, we were building things which now people buy routinely, and we took long times doing that. But it was fun.
Did you construct your own spectrometer?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. We built our own. At that point, Varian had just come into business. Varian had just begun to sell electromagnets of high resolution. Electromagnets, but we didn't have the money to buy a power supply for these things. So I built one of our hard regulated magnetic power supplies for an electromagnet.
I see.
And I learned a lot of electronics and took a lot of time. it was fun. It was something I enjoyed very much. A lot of mechanical work, a lot of electronic work. We did a lot working with controlling of magnetic magnets of various kinds,
mm-hmm.
and I did spend a lot of my subsequent career on magnetism and
right.
and magnetic technology.
Did you feel that in the research topic that you finally struck upon, you were able to get that blend of theory and experiment that suited your inclination?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I think the thing I was most proud of in my thesis work was actually a theory that I did of molecular afterglows, which was an old subject, which has eventually became a kind of an important new subject, and I did a thing called cyclotron resonance in these so-called molecular afterglows, and it was a very interesting subject, and I learned a lot about gas discharges and things of that sort, and really found this an interesting juxtaposition of experiment. The experiments were hard, but they eventually worked, and the theory was not even there at that point, and I had the fun of sort of working through the theory.
Interesting.
So I really enjoyed what I put together for a thesis.
As you could see that your research was coming together and that there was an end point in sight, what were your career thoughts at that time?
I wasn't interested at all in academia. And I'm not sure why. I think there were some very naive notions that I was working on. And I was, I had a roommate an office mate at that point who was actually beginning to some early interviews with Bell Labs. He eventually went to Bell Labs.
Okay.
And I was beginning to see that there was an opportunity for doing good research in the industrial environment, and that seemed to me to be exactly what I wanted to do.
Was it the question of application or social impact that was coloring your attitude toward academia at that point?
I'm not sure I've really ever pieced that out. It was. It seemed to me that I was enjoying what I was doing as a graduate student, as I've observed in my later career, that is a very good time for people, even though it seems like drudgery at the time.
Right.
It's a very good time in the sense of being able to almost do what you want, and it seemed that the industrial thing would allow me to continue that.
Okay.
And I think for most people, industrial science, in fact, was, in the good old days of Bell Laboratories, I think that was certainly a very rich experience.
Yes. So then, did you embark on a round of interviews with
Yep.
industrial laboratories?
I went through the usual rounds, and I had some offers from fairly, I would say, hard industrial things like, I think, Exxon and you know, sort of the typical sort of chemical laboratory,
right,
more directed research kind of things. But, and a lot of people were interested in exploring various aspects of magnetic resonance at that point for a variety of chemical applications.
Okay.
And so I was getting lots of offers.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a very good offer from Bell Labs, and to work basically in sort of continuing my work in gas discharge, because at that point, remember, vacuum tubes are still an important part of the technology.
Of course.
And although there was a fellow by the name of Homer Hackstrom who ran a very, very good research group at Bell Labs. This was, you know, part of the really researchy part of Bell Labs, where the research was pretty free.
Right.
And he had a very good group working in a variety of problems in gas discharge, and they were very interested in the work I'd done for my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably I would have, if I'd gone there, I would have probably started work on things I'd done in my thesis, and then sort of worked off from that, which was a fairly typical Bell Labs pattern at that point.
Yeah.
Was to give people sort of a place to get a few papers out when they were at Bell Labs, and then to go on to something new.
Was that in the 1956 time period that you were...
55, 56. I have a little looseness on some of these dates, but I think the job offer was very early 56 from Bell Labs.
Okay. Well, when and how did William Shockley emerge in the mix?
That's an interesting experience. So I had already accepted a job at Bell Labs.
Okay.
And I had a research room at Berk Berkeley LeConte Hall. I was in, just off the hall there, and one day this little man walked into my lab and started asking me questions about my experiment and so forth, and then he introduced himself. I used to get also Mad Men because it was right across from the entrance to LeConte Hall, and often crazy people would walk in and ask me about aphorisms and so forth.
Okay, yeah.
And so I was guarded, I must say, when he walked into my lab and started asking questions. But then the questions were reasonably perceptive, and so I started paying more attention to him. So then he then confessed to what he wanted to talk to me about, that he had talked to Charlie Cattell. Do you know the name Charlie Cattell?
I do, yes.
Charlie Cattell was an outstanding theorist at Berkeley. And so Shockley told him about his attempts to recruit people, and Cattell said, well, why don't you go down and have a try at this guy Jones downstairs?
Okay.
And told him something about me. And so Shockley, I was in my working togs in the lab, but Shockley said, why don't you go get cleaned up and we'll go off for lunch. And we went off for lunch at the Fairmont Hotel for a starring graduate student.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a shock. But it was probably the most intense afternoon of physics that I had in quite a long time. And so Shockley and I spent, I would say, the next 6 or 7 hours in very intense discussions. And he happened to ask me about subjects which I knew a lot about, and so I showed up pretty well. And he thought they were very hard questions. And one of my greatest and most interested subjects has always been electromagnetic theory.
Okay.
And I had some very good courses in electromagnetic theory at Berkeley, and I maybe had sufficiently triggered my interest that I'd spent a lot of time studying things. And Shockley had just come from a visit with Feynman at Caltech,
mm-hmm.
and he had a number of paradoxes that he was interested in quizzing me about. And it turned out that I was, not because of any brilliance, but just because I happened to know this subject pretty well, I was able to cope with most of the paradoxes that he was talking about. And so Shockley was, I don't mean this to sound immodest, it had to do with the accident of a lot of things, but Shockley was impressed by me, and he made a real pitch to get me. But I said, no, look, I've already taken the job in at Bell Labs, and it's a good job. And of course, that was even a bigger push with him because he wanted to win a victory versus Bell Labs.
Right.
And So we this debate went on for several days about this, and I don't know if you picked up from the Shockley thing, they one of the things that Shockley was enamored of was having psychological profiles of his people. And he said, well, you know, you don't have to go, you don't have to come with me, but I'd like you to take this psychological profile because I'd like to calibrate these guys that are doing it. As a personal favor, would you do this, and so on. So I did this, and that was an interesting part of the interview. But at that point, I really wasn't inclined to go with them. I'd already sort of established my interest. I did have a strong interest in staying in California. I had a family in California, and my mother was getting on the older side at that point, although
right.
She lived to 100. So California, I also had a girlfriend at that point that lived in California, and so the idea of going to the East was not the most exciting thing, and there weren't many opportunities in California at that point. It was not,
yes.
It was not, certainly nothing like Bell Labs existed in California.
Mm-hmm.
So, by hook or crook, I ended up going to Shockley. I became sort of a person non grata at Bell Labs for the rest of my life. But whenever I'd meet somebody from Bell Labs in subsequent years, they would say, oh, you're the guy. because at that point, you didn't turn
No, it must have captured their attention, certainly.
Yeah. So that's how I got to Shockley.
How were you aware of Shockley's reputation?
Not to the degree that I became aware of it.
Right.
I mean, in retrospect, it was a very naive decision process, but I was young.
But his technical, scientific reputation...
was high. Oh, I knew his scientific reputation.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was trying to... Yeah. That's what I should have said.
One of my closest friends at Berkeley was a fellow by the name of Gene Dresselhaus, who was one of Cattell's outstanding students. And so I was very aware of what was going on in contemporary solid-state physics.
Okay.
I mean, I had taken Cattell's course and things like that. I mean, Cattell brought solid-state physics to Berkeley.
Right.
And so I was aware of a lot of the work in his group, and I knew Arthur Kipp, who was an experimentalist working with Cattell, knew him quite well. And so I was aware of the personas in solid-state physics, and in fact, one of the reasons I did cyclotron resonance in the gases was the fact that one of the hot issues at that point was doing cyclotron resonance in semiconductor materials. And through my, Gene Dresselhaus did an extensive theoretical analysis of cyclotron resonance in solid-state materials.
Oh.
In semiconductors.
Uh-huh.
And then so I was sort of inclined to have a crack at it in gases, and indeed, after a lot of work, it actually worked, and that was what I did. My thesis had sort of a couple of pieces, but that was the dominant piece of my thesis.
Right.
So I was well aware of who Shockley was, and but I didn't know about all the crazy stories.
Right.
I'm not sure if I knew them, if it would have changed my mind, but, that's life.
What was his, at the time he was recruiting you, how did Shockley describe the nature of his new operation and its intent?
Yeah, I think his view was that, these interesting devices had been invented at Bell Labs, using all of the wondrous opportunities that Bell Labs offered for doing pure research, and or at least directed research of a certain kind.
Right.
But yet, it wasn't able to capitalize on these by moving forward solid state technology. His feeling was that the opportunity was there to do things that weren't being done, and that the technology should move forward. And in particular, he and Maury Tannenbaum had invented and developed the so-called MESA transistor.
Yes.
Which is what I said in our earlier discussion. The MESA transistor, to me, has always characterized a major metaphorical development in modern technology in ways we can describe if it's useful. And Shockley put forward, in our discussions, he put forward the business that there were new opportunities in semiconductor device development which were not being exploited. I think that was a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
And that he viewed what he wanted to develop, and I think to some extent he was triggered by some of the Hewlett-Packard concepts of trying to get a group of people who were research level scientists but would be conscious of getting something out the door.
Okay.
And And I don't know how much that Hewlett-Packard thing figured in there, but as you probably know, Hewlett-Packard worked for many years on the philosophy of people taking a device from the basics to the market.
Okay.
And whether Shockley was, because I know he was very familiar with Hewlett-Packard's operation, whether he picked that up from them or whether it was something that came from him, I don't know. But the idea was that he would recruit people who were could make their living as research scientists, but who would have the willingness to bring stuff to utility.
I've
got to say that to me was an attractive thought. I've always viewed myself, probably always, as an applied physicist in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I could have articulated it at that point, but as life has gone along, that is what I enjoy.
Could we return to your comment and explore a little bit further what you mean about the MESA transistor, the diffuse junction transistor, as a metaphorical development?
Well, and I have not done the historic research to know whether Shockley is the unique figure in this regard, but mm-hmm. I suspect he is. But the what Shockley articulated at that point was the fact that what was going on in the development of transistors at that point was you needed to make things small.
Right.
And the big issue is that in the physics of a let's say a PNP transistor, the base region is the crucial parameter.
Mm-hmm.
And the base region has to be kept small, thin, for a whole variety of reasons. Namely, if it's too thick, then the electrons injected from the base from the emitter into the base won't get to the collector junction. So
right.
It has to be physically thin. The technology that was existing at that point was developed around various mechanical means for making that thin by skinning down the devices into very small, thin devices.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, I'm coughing here. Let me get a drink here.
Sure.
Shockley, I think that, well, let me just parenthetically note that Bob Noyce, when he came to join the Shockley thing, had been working at Philco on a methodology for making very, very thin base regions on transistors, which was a mechanical marvel in some sense. But it was obvious that you weren't going to be able to do that. You know, you weren't going to be able to keep making things smaller and smaller by basically mechanical means.
I see.
So Shockley said, what you have to do is you have to use some natural processes. You have to use the control of natural processes to make transistors. And so what became the metaphor for the diffuse-based transistor, let me clear my throat.
Surely.
What became the technology for the diffuse-based transistor was to start with a plain semiconductor surface, and then to use processes of sequential diffusion
mm-hmm.
to differentially build structures in the vertical direction from the plane down.
Right.
And I think that's where I think is one of the key metaphors of our time, because if you look at any technology now, acoustical technology and biotechnology, the idea of building structures from planar structures which are etched and diffused and subsequent techniques that have used that, it seems to me is a dominant metaphor for industrial technology. And I don't think that I've seen examples of that being used in other technologies before that. I could be wrong. When I posed this with Jay Last at our recent luncheon,
yes,
he thought it was an interesting thought. He wasn't quite sure he believed it. But it's been been a sort of thing that I've hacked at it for some time, in the sense that almost every technology, including biotechnology now, has sort of grown on this notion of being able to build things on planar structures, and the fact that you control first and foremost things that are happening from the vertical surface down, and then you use whatever techniques you can to control things laterally.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the whole business of photolithography, et cetera,
right.
All those kind of techniques have just permeated every facet of technology, optoelectronics. My son works in bio applications of planar structures of this sort and so on. So it just is a rich technical metaphor, and to my view, it first emerged in that in the context of the diffuse base transistor.
Right, and certainly it sounds as if Shockley was putting that foremost to getting a...
Oh yes, no, the diffuse base technology was one of the fundamental design ideas that he was putting forward. And that he felt that, I don't know what the history of the labs was, but that he felt it was insufficiently appreciated in its development. Now, I had conversations with Maury Tenenbaum in later years about this, and he recognizes that it was a new metaphor that had been developed with Shockley, and he didn't deny that it probably wasn't made useful by Bell Labs as in the way that Shockley had hoped.
Right.
And that may have been some of the reason that he moved out. But I really don't have much insight into that history.
Mm-hmm. Sticking again with this period of the active recruitment of you by Shockley, did he discuss a strategy for his new operation with respect to crystal material at all?
No, I think at that point I was. He didn't talk about that, but it was quite clear that when we got in the business, that was a serious issue. But I think it was more the diffusion technology as a basis of device development was the key
right.
matter.
Okay.
And I think secondly, or maybe firstly, the idea of taking research level people to the development.
Okay.
And you know, I think what I would say is that certainly was a correct assumption in Intel. I mean, the success of Fairchild at Intel certainly bore that point out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think all the people that were active in those early developments would certainly be of the caliber who could operate in a research laboratory.
Right. When was it then that your first day at Shockley Semiconductor occurred?
I'm not sure the first day. It's early '56. I hadn't really I hadn't submitted my thesis yet, but I was started working. I mean, my thesis was done, but I was putting together a few things, and I think I appeared somewhere in the early '56.
Okay.
I don't really have a good hold on that time.
Okay.
But it was kind of a disastrous thing, because it was with all the high-minded stuff, the putting together the laboratory was something less than Jay Last once characterized it as the putty factory.
Yeah.
it was an old garage. Well, in fact, when I started with him, there was nothing. We were sort of sitting around a storefront somewhere. There were a strange group of people there. I mean, most of the later people had not yet been recruited. And there was a fellow by the name of Bill Happ.
Right.
There was a fellow by the name of Louis, Louis, Valdez, Leo Valdez.
Right.
And and a fellow by the name of Shmoot Horsley. And
right.
Those were the people, and this was not. I was taken aback. This was not Berkeley. This was not Berkeley Science. And I was taken aback by that, but of course Shockley was there. Shockley put me to work on another device which had complications, and that was the four-layer diode.
Okay.
Which he immediately said, you're a good theorist, why don't you understand the theory of the four-layer diode, because we're going to make them. And I got to say that the four-layer diode is still, to me, one of the most complicated devices in the world. It was a remarkable device, and it was obviously born on the model of some gaseous discharge devices that I knew about.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, the theory was wild and very nonlinear theory. And as I said, in for other reasons, I have spent time looking at that theory in subsequent years, and still believe it's one of the toughest things to put. It was a tough thing to put a guy who knew nothing about semiconductor physics on, but that's what Shockley did.
That was
I spent most of my time reading and trying to learn about four-layer diodes. Now, the reasons for Shockley's interest in the four-layer diode, and again, I think this triggered some of the later problems with the staff,
yeah,
was that he saw this for telephone crossbar switching.
Right.
And indeed, it is a very interesting device, would have done that, but I think there are other ways in which that's been accomplished in subsequent time. But it still is a very interesting device, and it is useful in some technical applications. But I think Shockley saw sort of using base, because this is sort of an ultimate use of an ultimate but fairly simple use of his planar technology. Namely, what you had to do is to diffuse in four layers, and
yes.
You didn't even have to make contact. You only had to make contact with the top and the bottom,
right?
And you had the device. And I think what he saw, I'm somewhat projecting here, but I think what he saw was the fact that you could put a whole bunch of these on one chip,
mm-hmm.
and you had a crossbar,
right?
And whether he really saw it that way, I don't know, but it would not have been a stretch to imagine that. So I think, even though it seems crazy at that time to have been sort of going that distance, I think the idea of building a chip of crossbar switches was not too bad a stretch.
Mm-hmm. Was there an issue? I've heard varying things about the four-layer diode. One of which was that the real issue with it, from a sort of manufacturing point of view, was that it was awfully hard to get uniformity from diode to diode, because the diffusions were so delicate.
That's correct. That is for sure.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, to build a CMOS device, I think had similar challenges, and the challenges could be met.
Right.
I think the layer, you know, the PNP junction, the three-layer device,
yes,
was simpler, but on the other hand, you had to make contact with the intermediate layer, and
right.
So that made it harder. I'm not sure one can make and at this distance, I don't think you can make a good parse of which device is the most desirable.
Right.
I think that probably the more pressing point is that the four-layer diode is a fantastic device for telephone switching. But if you're trying to sell a general purpose device which would go into many, many different products, I don't think it's a very good choice.
I see.
I mean, I think, you know, it's a little bit, after all, the bipolar transistor is a little bit like a general computer. It's a device that can be used in
right.
for many, many different purposes.
Right.
Whereas the PN, the four-layer diode is has a very unique function.
I see. Yeah. Right.
But it's you know, I once played with the idea of sort of semiconductor optoelectronic devices, which would mm-hmm. mimic the functions of the retina and things like that.
Yeah.
And the four-layer diode would be a crucial element in sort of a synaptic synaptic-like device, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
It had very much the response of a nerve synapse.
Okay.
And so it is a very interesting device, and I don't think it should be poo-pooed out of existence, but it certainly was not a good way to build a market position.
I see.
Which I think was the real criticism for of the people that left Shockley.
Okay. So just to make sure that I'm understanding you exactly, that was still in the days when Shockley Semiconductor Laboratory was a handful of people in a storefront that
yeah.
Shockley gave you the tall order of getting your head around the four-layer diode theory.
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, I think it was basically a smart thing. I mean, he knew that I was bridled by the particular people I was dealing with were not inspirational.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was probably afraid that I would take off because I had really no particular strong bonds there.
Okay.
And I think he was just trying to give me something challenging.
Okay.
But I also spent a lot of time on things like finding, helping to find a lab space, and to which we eventually ended up with an old garage that that became the putty factory in Jay Last's terms, and recruiting, people, and I took a lot of traveling. I traveled a lot with Shockley, in the sense that he was trying to recruit people at various places, and he had recruited me away from Bell Labs, and so he sort of used that as a as a device. I mean, this guy has made a commitment. Why won't you make a commitment? And so on.
Right.
And so I remember going to visit in New York Eugene Kleiner, and I remember going off and meeting Jay Last in Cambridge and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I would travel around to see people. And also, Shockley was trying to pick up funding from various places. He had a big connection with the Army, and he kept trying to sell them four-layer devices and so on. So there was a lot of traveling around to keep the word out, to do recruiting, to pick up some money, to
right
to get papers, because Shockley never gave up on his desire to become a technical person. In fact, just to jump ahead of the story a little bit, I think one of the key problems that occurred, and I think most people would agree with this, is that Shockley was never clear whether he wanted to be the greatest entrepreneur, scientific entrepreneur, technical entrepreneur, Edison, or whether he still wanted to be the Nobel Prize winner.
Right.
And so people would come in one day, and everything was to produce papers that could be published. The next day, they'd come in, and he'd be disturbed that we hadn't taken over the market of new devices.
I see.
And I think that ambivalence underlies a tremendous number of the problems that always plague the Shockley Labs.
Were the first group of people who you met in the storefront, Bill Happ, Leo Valdez, and Smoot Horsley, were Happ and Valdez from, they were Bell Lab or Bell System?
Bill Happ had been with Raytheon. And,
okay.
And he had worked on semiconductor devices at Raytheon. Leo Valdez had been a real actor in the Bell Labs device development. So he knew a lot about device physics and so forth. And he, in fact, was he was targeted to be the guy who was going to do materials for Shockley. So he he was spending this time planning to build, you know, conventional crystal growers and was ordering parts and things of that sort.
Okay.
So he was the most experienced person. He was somebody who had some autonomy. I think until Bob Noyce came, he was Bob Noyce was obviously very experienced in semiconductors.
Yes.
From I think he had been 3 years at Philco.
Right.
And so he knew. I would say of this early group of people, it was only Leo Valdez and Bob Noyce who came somewhat later, who knew anything about semiconductors. In fact, Jay Last and Gordon Moore and myself, we knew Butkus about semiconductors. In fact, we used to get up an hour earlier every morning and give each other seminars, and we used to go through the classic papers on semiconductors because we felt that we were tremendously disadvantaged.
The three of you.
Three of us, yeah.
I see.
I think that was the three of that did it. I think Sheldon Roberts showed up on occasion, but I think he was less concerned with that because he came as a materials person.
Right.
And his not knowing sort of device physics was not something that bothered him too much, although he did come to these seminars on occasion.
I see.
And so we were desperately trying to get ourselves into the place where we knew something, because none of us had any sort of academic experience in that regard.
When did the crystal grower project, the inklings of that first become visible?
The lore at that point was that first of all, Shockley had made an absolute we were talking about what were the sort of organizing principles of the laboratory. I left out the third one, namely that we'd only work with silicon.
Right.
Because at that point, silicon was a monster. Because the lifetimes in silicon were just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because of the higher temperature, it was a very, very much more difficult material to work with. And the greatest thing, of course, is that silicon dioxide was the greatest material in the universe, as it came down to being. But and initially, it was horrible because everything was hydrofluoric acid.
Right.
So silicon, for a lot of the people in semiconductor technology, was an absolute monster. And so people were making germanium devices. So there were only germanium devices that were out there at that point. But the Shockley thing was silicon. I mean, we were going to make it with silicon. We were going to solve the problems of silicon. And one of the key problems was the notion that defects were being incorporated from the graphite crucibles in which the crystals were being grown. And so one had to get away from graphite crucibles, and that supposedly these were oxygen defects of some sort or another, not well defined at that point.
Right.
But they were clearly, I mean, Shockley always had in his mind the history of Dethnium. You probably know.
I have. You heard, yeah.
He always had in mind the Dethnium story, and so the problem was he had to solve the lifetime issue in silicon.
Right.
So we were working. In fact, there was another thing I sort of got deeply involved in. I was doing calculations on how to do a floating zone thing with silicon, which was much more difficult because of, again, the higher temperatures and so forth. And we did work up some designs for silicon floating zone techniques. Again, vertical columns and very much like what has later evolved in silicon floating zone, but these were the problem was that you had to control the RF heating to a sufficient degree. That's a nonlinear process that can kill you, and how do you get the correct control circuits and so forth. So I spent a lot of time on that issue. And Shockley and I were on one of these trips, and we got started talking about this whole issue of how to grow silicon without a crucible.
Right.
And I don't know, somehow in our conversation, I may have first posed it, I don't know, but somehow in our conversation, we got into this idea, why not use silicon as the crucible, and mm-hmm. and how would you do that, and what's different ways you could do that, and I think I first put the idea forward because it had resonance with something else I'd once done, and I really can't put the history together, and I don't want to make any claims on it. In the process, I said, well, what if you had this little surface heater maybe that you bring the whole silicon thing up to mm-hmm. to close to the melting temperature, and then you have a small resistance heater at the surface to just heat a puddle, and then you pull it out the puddle. And so we spent the rest of the night talking about that. It was a transcontinental trip. In those days, that was a long
right.
That was a long night. And so we, by the time we got to Washington, headed, we had pretty well scoped out what we were thinking about on that. It seemed like a good idea, and so when we got back, as I mentioned, I really enjoy sort of dirt down and dirty experimental kinds of things.
Right.
And so I got together. I took a chemical oven, a simple laptop. Table chemical oven that went to 150 degrees, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I built a little surface heater and got a pool of Woods metal. Woods metal is a good experimentalist's a trick. I was obviously trying to impress Shockley, and I think in about a day of fooling around, I grew little ingots of woods metal using this technique, and with a little, I had a little drill motor, and pulled up through this surface heater,
right?
And voila, there was it wasn't single crystal because I don't know even how you would do that, but it was a boule of woods metal.
Mm-hmm.
I think woods metal melts at something like 80 degrees centigrade.
Okay.
So I took this in and showed it to Shockley, and of course he was ecstatic. And I think as I look back on this thing, this is the greatest one of the greatest mistakes I ever made in my life. Because Shockley thought, Jesus, it was so easy to do this, so that we did this in one day, and we just go from here now to silicon. And I said, well, you know, we really should work out some of these other things. He said, no. He says, you haven't got the big picture here. One has to move, and in this modern technology, you have to really be bold and so on. And so with that, he pulled in Knappich and Kleiner and Julie Blank, who were at that point underemployed, I would say, at that point. I mean,
okay.
Shockley had viewed them as people who were going to be doing production lines and things like that.
Yes.
I think they were underemployed at that point, and he asked Dean Knappich, you think you could do this? And of course, Dean Knappich would have said yes, no matter what the job was. I cautioned that, this is a big shift from silicon's melting point from Woods metal's melting point to silicon, and there were some problems there, but Shockley was absolutely convinced that we were going to do this, and so that began the adventure of building this thing. And of course, started to work up the technology of the things, and it was clearly a technological. It was a space race. We ended up with things like rolled molybdenum shields and titanium this, and it was incredibly expensive stuff.
Right.
And engineers and who could do this and who could do that. I spent a lot of traveling, a lot of things. And of course, it all had to be secret because Shockley was a very secretive guy, and he thought this was going to, you know, was going to revolutionize the world. So at some point, I wanted to realize whether I was totally wasting the rest of my life. And so somewhere between this, Valdez had left. Valdez and Shockley didn't get along, somewhat because Valdez, you know, thought he knew more about semiconductors than Shockley, and that was not a healthy working relationship, Shockley. And the whole crystal thing had sort of fallen in my lap, which is amazing because I had no previous experience with that kind of thing. But
right.
I had gotten, you know, real books on conventional techniques, and so we were growing. Sort of not very good, but we were growing reasonable silicon at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I went into one of the silicon growers, and of course the problem was if I put a surface heater in the way that sort of described with a RF heater, the surface heater would obviously heat up because of the RF, and so I had to. I sort of roughly shielded it somehow. I've forgotten exactly how I did this, but it was a kludge for sure. But I was able to pull a bit, to make a puddle in this grower, and I was able to reach down and pull up a crystal, and that's when I put that in my desk drawer, and then we went off. I mean, it was a feasibility that something like this could be done. Although obviously you couldn't build the real thing with an RF heater because you couldn't control what you were doing and so on. And so this crystal looks really funny because, you know, funny things were going on. But I was able to make them, you know, slower and hotter and so forth. So we did grow this little crystal. Of course, that again made Shockley ecstatic. I was so deeply mired in this thing at this point, I sort of needed this as some kind of reassurance that it wasn't total nonsense. And so I did grow that crystal, and I don't know if you had a chance to look at that webpage.
I did. I saw the photograph of the crystal.
And a number of years ago, one of my kids looked at my drawer and said, "What's that?" And I said, "Jeez," and I'd forgotten about it. That was the origin of that thing, so then this thing just became, you know, it grew like Topsy. I mean, I don't know if this was punishment or something, but it was mounted next to my desk, this old garage. I lost my hearing because somebody. Somebody popped off a gun, was putting up a steel structure, and he popped off a gun in my head, and, you know, near my ears, and I lost my hearing for about 7 months or something.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, I mean, this thing just grew and grew and grew. And, of course, it was a very complicated thing to build at that point because the technology in the Bay Area was not up to. I mean, all these guys had come from the East, and they, you know, they knew that there was always a guy to make vacuums over here and a guy to do this over there. And
right.
It just wasn't the kind of technological base in California at that point. So a lot of the stuff had to be imported. I think the tank of the thing was made at the shipyards in near San Francisco.
Okay.
And various components were being built up, but above all, the problem was how to get heat shielding on this thing because it would lose heat. I mean, because of resistance, as you correctly, it was resistance heated, and that was the only way that you could ever think about getting control in the system. And then that heat shielding had to be that resistance heater had to be shielded, and of course, this all at is a wonderful idea, because you really don't have to build everything to temperature. I mean, you have to build things to standard, but it's only the crucible that's getting hot.
Right.
And so the shielding issues are relatively simple, and it's very easy to get power in and out, and all those interesting things. Once you go to resistance heating, wow, is it a complicated business? And of course, it had to be vacuum, and just one problem after another.
Mm-hmm.
Compounded itself. It certainly contributed to my wanting to leave there, because I was obviously stuck with this monster. I also spent a lot of time with patent attorneys to try to develop the patent that I saw for the first time yesterday. The patent people were very good, and I've always enjoyed working with patent attorneys, because they can make your mind expand.
Right.
By the coverage, and I really haven't read the patent yet, but I would suspect that from the guys we had, probably the coverage is pretty good on it. So anyway, that was because they always ask you, can you use this for this? Can you use it for that?
Right.
And that was sort of the whole history of the thing, as far as I was concerned. Now, it did go on after I left, but at that point, I wasn't really central to it anyway. It was a mechanical. I mean, it was an engineering project at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But it was certainly a lesson that I learned for future work, namely that you don't take an idea half cooked and take it to the end point. I mean, you have to work up. You have to go ahead and get upstairs slowly.
Yeah.
But that, again, that was kind of a mistake of Shockley. He was out to beat the world in the shortest possible time, and he just wasn't patient.
Could I, maybe I'll just interrupt here for a couple different questions, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
One is about the floating zone work that you were doing prior to that flight where the two of you came up with this idea for the crystal grower.
By the way, we did not build any floating zone things. These were all on paper.
Okay. Now, was the idea there to use a floating zone method to further refine single crystals? I'm sorry.
To crystal grow.
To do crystal growing through a floating zone method.
In other words, to take a vertical boule.
Right.
Use the surface tension to keep the thing together.
Right.
Come down and pick up a seed at the bottom of a column.
Mm-hmm.
And then to move upward with
right.
the I think this actually has been done. I mean, I'm quite sure it's been done.
Yes.
Of course, the first floating zone was germanium in a dish, and that was used entirely for segregation of impurities.
Yes.
But my conclusion was, actually, I think it's a relatively simple problem now in terms of electronics, but at that point, control electronics was not very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sizable control problem to be able to stabilize that floating zone.
I see.
We did set down on paper, sort of, you would use an optical method to track what the size of the zone was, and then you would have feedback to varactors, which would control, or to magnetic amplifiers, which would control the RF generator and so forth, and you had to, you had to worry about feedback and lots of problems, which I'm sure could be worked out, but it was not a trivial control problem.
I know that you had an sort of electro-optical control system, at least in the patent, on the crystal grower.
Yep.
Was that a transfer?
I think it was, yeah.
Okay.
I never saw the draft of the patent before. It was kind of interesting to see that sort of hexagonal shape of the heat shields and so forth, because I remember drawing those on pieces of paper. But as I said, most of this was worked out with the patent attorney.
Okay.
And he would say, you know, how do you control this? And I'd say, well, you know, you could do this, you could do that, and I think some of that work was certainly coming from the floating zone stuff that I did.
I see.
But that's a long time ago.
And then to talk about the difference between, in terms of control, between the RF heater, an RF heating system, and a resistance heating system. I'm not quite sure that personally I quite understand why the resistance heating would give you greater control than the RF heating.
No. It's the following. If I want to control separately the heating of the puddle, I mean of the surrounding region.
Yes.
And I want to control separate from that the surface heater.
Yes.
To do that with RF is very difficult, because the radio frequency would couple not only into the crucible. I mean, why does the RF heat the thing? The RF couples into the graphite crucible. So
I see.
You heat the graphite, okay?
And, right.
And that heats obviously the silicon it contains. So the RF energy is being coupled into the graphite holder, and everything else is an insulator. So it doesn't. So the quartz is by and large not coupling to the RF and so forth. But now if you put a heater down on top of the in close proximity to the surface, the RF energy is going to couple into the heater as well.
Right. Okay.
So
okay.
Those are not separately controllable elements. So you would not be able to the idea here was just to bring the thing to a let's say within 20 or 30 degrees of the melting point.
Right.
Hold that surface and then come down with this the surface heater and add the additional heat to get the surface. Now, to control those two things separately, if you had a radio frequency coil, would have been a nightmare.
I mean, I see.
There's no way I could think about doing it.
Because it would be really hard to control what temperature the surface heater would.
The point is that I think I did do this when I did the experiment that made that little crystal.
Yes.
What I did is I basically pushed the graphite thing as high as I could up in the coil, so that the RF coil was basically heating the bottom of the crucible, and then I came in on the top with the heater coil.
Right.
And there was certainly some coupling, but it wasn't quite as disastrous as it would be if it were trying to do it in some other way.
I see.
Now, whether it could have been done with RF by some clever thing, I don't know. But I certainly time couldn't think of any clever way of doing it.
Another question I had was when you were mentioning the secrecy. Keeping it a trade secret, what you were up to. Certainly that was keeping it secret from the outside, I guess the various vendors you were talking to. Was there any internal secrecy about the crystal grower?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't think I know the answer to that, or I don't remember the answer to that. It was not something. I mean, certainly it wasn't secret with the regard to the, you know, Julie Blank and Napic and Miner. It was never discussed. That's an interesting point. It was never discussed with any of the other people.
Yeah.
That I remember. I remember having some discussion. Along here came Victor Greenwich, who came on board.
And right.
He was the only person around who was an electrical engineer. And I did remember having some discussions with him about control circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember ever having a conversation with Shockley which said, don't tell the other guys about this.
Okay.
But it was there was no attempt to have a sort of brainstorming session with other smart people, or with smart people, which I think could have been very useful. I think, in general, things were very compartmentalized in the Shockley. For example, there was work on lithography going on,
right,
which I was not privy to, and I think it was only, you know, in later life that I learned what was going on there. So there was a tendency to keep things very separate.
And that
Shockley didn't trust people. I mean,
okay.
No question about that.
Another question that I had was I know at one point. Well, I don't know. I've heard that at one point there was a tremendous electrical short that happened with the grower. And in talking to Julius Blank, the way he recalls it was that it was at Leo Valdez's insistence that the crystal grower incorporated sapphire rods as sort of a non-contaminating support for some of the resistance windings.
Yeah, well,
and that they...
that's got to be wrong, because Valdez wasn't there at that point.
Oh, he had left prior to that.
Yeah, I mean, number one, whatever thing there was after I was there, after I left.
Uh-huh.
I don't... The device was never fired up in anger while I was there. Valdez had absolutely nothing to do with the design of this thing, because by that time Shockley had got rid of him.
Huh? Did he work on the project at all?
No.
Huh?
No, not at all. No, in fact, absolutely not. No.
Okay.
I mean, my memory is clouded for lots of things these days, but no, the Valdez thing was a very, very trying thing for me personally, because I was in a very loose situation. I mean, Jay Lass and I were in a very loose situation here, because we were just guys. We had no family commitments or anything of the sort, but a lot of the people had come there, had moved their families under great stress.
Yes.
To come out there, and Shockley soon blistered with his relationship to Valdez, and Shockley wanted to get rid of him early on, and I sort of kept trying to make his case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of got in a situation where I was being viewed as Valdez's advocate.
Right.
And Shockley would then sort of direct all his venom at me to you know, get with the drill, and so I was very much familiar with the whole dynamic of him.
Okay.
Out the door, and he was never involved in this thing at all.
That's interesting, because in fact,
Shockley would never have trusted him.
So it's interesting, because in the perceptions of others, obviously, that several people have linked his departure with sort of Shockley's frustration about the large crystal grower.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
No, absolutely not. No, the as I mentioned before.
Yes.
Leo had sort of bought a lot of equipment for the conventional crystal grower.
Oh.
And so a lot of the early stuff we had there for the crystal grower was Valdez. I think Leo must have grown something on the first crystals we had there, and so on. But this was a conventional RF heated.
Right.
Device. No, Valdez had nothing. And I think the thing which gives me confidence on that is that Shockley viewed this as one of our great secrets.
And, right.
And given the fact that almost from day one, he and Valdez were at each other's throat, and Shockley knew that Leo would go off to some other semiconductor company, he would never have
involved
in this thing.
Okay.
I mean, that's what makes me confident that that's... I think he worried less about me because here I was a neophyte in semiconductor industry. And so, you know, I was a virgin mind, whereas he certainly viewed Valdez as a competitor.
So perhaps people are conflating Leo Valdez's efforts with conventional crystal growing with your crystal grower.
I don't know whether Leo actually ever grew a crystal with the machinery he bought, but he bought most of the machinery. I sort of got saddled with that after Valdez left because I grew a lot of crystals there, and it was appropriate since I was doing this other thing that I do that.
Using a conventional crystal grower.
We had a number of famous accidents, we once had a sort of a show and tell for local industry, and I was growing crystals with arsenic, and this makes arsine gas, and the envelope, the quartz envelope,
yes,
the grower broke, and I had to get people out of that garage delicately, so I couldn't tell them they were all about to get arsenic poisoning. My technician and I, we did pick up a bit of it.
Who was your technician?
I've actually forgotten his name.
Okay.
It was a nice kid who worked in one of the, it came from one of the community colleges, but I've forgotten his name.
Was the Blank-Kleiner combination involved in helping to make not only the large crystal grower, but the conventional crystal growers as well?
Well, I think later on they did.
Okay.
They took but I don't remember that transition. I think I was, until I left, I was pretty much doing the crystals.
And did you, but the large crystal grower had not been sort of operated until after you left?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, did, one thing that I have personally puzzled over is, with Sheldon Roberts in this period, you know, here's a metallurgist, somebody who had grown crystal or had experience with crystals, but he seemed to have been not in the center of the crystal growing activity.
That's correct.
Do you have any thoughts?
He was in the middle of the diffusion.
Yeah.
Technology. Well, again, I think this was a Shockley separation of things because. I'm pretty sure that Sheldon knew what we were doing, and I think, I've never had that conversation with him, but I think he thought it was a crackpot idea, but I don't think it ever bubbled into a full-fledged conversation. He was not working on crystal growing, though.
Right. I guess in talking with him, he said that he really hadn't been... really didn't know what was going on. I guess he had no really, apparently had no real opinion about it because had sort of never been briefed in.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. I'm sure he was. You know, we were in conversations about the conventional growers because that was a, you know, that was well known process. And I suspect. I mean, as I said, this garage was a funny place because it was this gigantic space, and whenever you grew a crystal, there was a gigantic light over in the corner, and so people would come over and say, "Hey, what?"
Oh.
It was very communal in that. So there was no secrecy about the conventional crystal growing, and
Right.
By the time I left, it was a going business, and I'm sure that, I mean, but there was nothing mysterious. I mean, that was such a well-known technique that
right.
I mean, after Valdez left, I stepped in, and you know, within a day or so, was able to master that technique, and I think I'm pretty sure I put together most of the apparatus and so on.
Okay.
But but certainly Leo. You know, he just went to, you know, to standard Bell Labs. I mean, some of these guys arrived with ordering information from there. Bill Happ was the same way. He arrived with, I think, some of the first diffusion furnaces. That wouldn't have been true. But I remember Bill Happ arriving with stuff from Raytheon, where he just, you know, repeated orders of things that had been...
Oh, all their prior vendors.
Right.
I understand. Yeah. Oh, okay, sure.
And I think, I remember Valdez, so he'd gone from Bell Labs to a diode maker in L.A., what were they called? And he had set up some crystal growing facilities there and so forth. So, I mean, he, you know.
Okay.
I think when we were in the storefront, he was ordering materials for RF generators and things like that.
Okay.
For things. So, there was pretty much all that stuff was in place when I came to take over the thing. And I really don't remember whether Valdez had grown crystals or not. But he certainly had, you know, bought all the materials and so on. So
I see.
It was not a great stretch to make that work.
Could we talk then about...
One last point. I mean, I had a lot of experience in gas handling systems and so on when I was a graduate student because I'd done gaseous research and so on. I mean, that was probably the only thing was, you know, you had to have gas handling systems and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you then about when you started to think this is not where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it was before the crystal grower was complete.
No, I mean the crystal grower certainly was a worrisome thing, but
uh-huh.
By that time. I was moving on to other things. I was actually beginning to do some device work at that point.
Okay.
And you know, it had been sort of taken over by NAPIC, Julie Blank and Co.
Okay.
But I was certainly involved in it. But you know, it had become sort of this technical monster.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I want to go? Well, Shockley had made a promise to me when I came on board. You know, I had said, you know, I got this wonderful job at Bell Labs, and you're asking me to come into this uncertain land. And Shockley had promised me. He said, you know, if you come on board, I will make every effort to see that you go on to do what you want to do. If it doesn't work out. And I must say, he was absolutely true to his commitment.
Hmm.
I went to him after much soul searching. I realized that I was not doing things that I wasn't enjoying, and I certainly didn't feel I was moving scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
Because partly is the fact that this kludge was just taking an enormous amount of time, and I was
right.
It was not particularly well. That and the fact that sort of Shockley involved me in every management flip-flop. I mean, there's a dynamic that Shockley uses. He identifies young people as sort of surrogate sons.
Okay.
And this I've shared with some earlier surrogate sons of Shockley. Maury Tenenbaum had been a surrogate son.
Okay.
Mike Galt at Bell Labs had been a surrogate son. And Shockley sort of identifies young people that he makes sort of confidants. I think it was, I certainly was confident on certain aspects of the Shockley early management problems, and so I was fairly frank with him when I just said I didn't feel that I was moving scientifically and that I felt bogged down, and of course the thing he was very concerned about is that I would go off to another job in semiconductor industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already anticipated that, and I really felt that the best thing for me to do was to take basically a academic job as a sabbatical kind of thing.
I see.
Or deep pressure, I would say.
Yeah.
The Shockley thing was very high pressure, and I felt that I needed to go to what I would then perceive as a quieter environment.
Yeah.
So I went to him, and when he raised this issue about, are you going to become a competitor? And I made very clear to him that I really would prefer to go into an academic place to decompress. And so with that, he wrote a letter to a number of people, extolling my virtues, which is a peculiar letter because it says I had run the safety committee, which most academic places aren't very interested in. But at any rate, so he wrote to quite a number of his National Academy type people, and I was well received in a job search.
I see.
So I went off and talked to a lot of people. And Shockley viewed it as an organizational problem, so he convened a general meeting of everybody and told them what I was doing, and he read the letter to everybody and that he was sending out to people, and so that was an attempt to get over this.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I was approached by Beckman. Shockley had sold me big to Beckman.
By Arnold Beckman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Beckman was concerned that I was leaving and that was falling apart. And Beckman did approach me to go on his staff as a liaison person.
Oh, interesting.
And thankfully, I did not bite on that because that would have been. I can't imagine anything which is closer to a living hell that would have been living hell. And so I politely declined on that. But I think it was a measure of the fact that Beckman was getting a sudden panic.
The panic was about,
he told to his backers that Shockley was this great, was going to do a lot of good for Beckman Industries.
Right.
I wasn't the only story he was hearing.
Okay.
But Shockley had told him that I was leaving, and that certainly triggered that whole response.
So had Beckman heard, for example, that Valdez had been fired, or
I don't know about that. Probably he had. I would be surprised if he hadn't.
I'm just wondering, go into it the extent that you want to, about, one person leaving, to go to an to return to academia, does not necessarily seem a cause for panic for somebody like an Arnold Beckman, or a sense that the place is falling apart. I'm thinking about the sequence here of what else is in the context, if that's the period of time when some of the other folks were calling up Arnold Beckman.
No, I don't think so yet.
Yeah.
No, I don't think. I mean, he was getting, well, first of all, you have to realize, I'm sure you do realize, that Shockley had this reputation elsewhere
right.
of being a madman.
Right.
And certainly Beckman had to cope with that. I mean, he certainly was aware of that from the very beginning. And to whatever people he had to account to, he had because it, you know, as I later learned, I mean, it was a lot of people who felt that Shockley was an unstable personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that Beckman, and I think as comes out in Leslie Berlin's book, Beckman went through two or three gyrations on
yeah.
what she would back Shockley and so forth, because it was a complex issue for him. And here is a tremendously successful businessman, and this marked probably his greatest failure. I think the reason why did I figure? Well, the reason I figured, I think, was the fact that there were two or three people, I think, that Shockley viewed as prizes and talked
yes.
all the time. And again, I mean, this sounds terribly self-serving, but he had used me as an example that here was a guy from Berkeley,
right.
a good place, and was going to Bell Labs and had made his
right.
a pact to come work for him.
Okay.
And certainly, I mean, Bob Noyce is somebody he talked about in this context. I'm sure there were others. So
mm-hmm.
in terms of his success at that point, it was in terms of recruitment,
because right.
of the device coming out the door.
Right.
So recruitment was a measure of how successful you are. So if one
okay.
of the guys you've been selling big to your financier
yeah.
Is taking off, the last thing in the world Shockley wants that, he wants Beckman to hit that from him, not from somewhere else.
Okay, I see.
I mean, I hate these statements because they sound like I'm saying that I was the most
knowledgeable
person in the world. But in terms of the game that Shockley was playing, I was some kind of valuable thing.
Yeah, a key, yeah. It also, you know, it's very interesting, your comment about Shockley's prior reputation at Bell Labs, for example, and Arnold Beckman having to sort of contend with that fact in establishing Shockley Semiconductor. I'm just wondering if that informs Beckman later on, when he was facing, you know, sort of that mass, the larger rebellion or whatever, and his eventual decision to back Shockley.
Yep.
You know, it's sort of, it's almost, I think of face saving or something like that. That
I'm sorry, what?
Or face saving yep. in a way that...
Yeah, I think that's definitely... I'm sure you know this history better than I do, but
well,
but I think Beckman did appoint some people in the role that he had discussed with me.
Yes, he tried.
I think they took somebody from the Berkeley division
yeah.
and put him into that role, which I don't think was a very fortunate role to be in.
Right.
I think he was trying to pull it out. I think the point is that he had backed Shockley a lot based on, I mean, Shockley was a charismatic personality and Nobel Prize winner, and you don't get many guys as smart as Shockley trying to set up a business, and you know, I think Beckman had taken a hunch. He had believed his hunch, and the hunch turned out to be only semi-wrong, because again,
right.
as I mentioned before, the sponge did turn out to revolutionize the silicon industry.
Sure.
And but it's just Shockley couldn't do it. So Beckman's decision was not that bad a decision. It was just he didn't understand the instability of Shockley.
Right.
And I think there was a lot of things. I mean, Terman was very much backing this to the hilt. I mean, there was Terman always had this thing about building up, you know, the
right.
industries and so on. And I'm sure, to some extent, he was a very strong inertial effect in keeping everybody straight on with this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is way over my pay grade, so I'm just hypothesizing here.
Well, Another issue that I wanted to talk about was during your tenure there at Shockley Semiconductor, from a number of people I've talked to, they described a dynamic that was difficult to contend with, which was Shockley really advocating to get quickly going on new ideas, but very much sort of but that entailing a constantly changing agenda or priority list, because he would be seized with a new idea or a new direction, and a lot of energy would go toward that, and then there would be a new priority. Was that something you encountered?
I alluded to that earlier.
Yes, you did.
That it wasn't just product instability in that regard, but it was goals. I mean, it was
right.
One minute it was to publish a really good paper on you know, silicon lifetimes, and the next minute it was to get a device out the door.
Right.
And I think, and again, given the sort of compartmentalization of the lab, I think it was also a particular problem, because people would hear that at one place he was writing the paper with somebody, and you know, if you were slogging away trying to get the thing closer to a business, you would get a bit jealous, so I think there were a lot of complicated dynamics
right.
going on here about ambiguity of mission, and I think that was very central part of it. I mean, the four-layer diode versus the bipolar transistor was
right.
certainly one element of that. The idea of other ways of crystal growing. I mean, I think he was working with Sheldon Roberts on other possibilities of growing from other kinds of melts and things like that. I mean, other ideas like this, but you know, it was very compartmentalized, so there was a compartmentalized. Was it a business issue or was it a scientific issue that you were dealing with, and so on?
I see.
And I think Shockley pursued that. One of the first things I remember when I came to Harvard, I came to Harvard because of John Van Leck, who had always been one of my scientific heroes, Shockley had written a particularly nice letter to Van Leck on my behalf, and that was a great inducement for me. And Van Leck had refereed a Shockley paper soon after I got there, in which Shockley had made some mistakes on magnetism, and it became really a nasty affair, because Shockley viewed the fact that his paper was not. Was criticized. I mean, here's, after all, a Nobel Prize winner, and Physical Review wasn't going to publish the paper. Van got very, very nervous because Shockley took such an angry tone about this thing. But it was part of the fact that Shockley was. I mean, why he was writing a paper on magnetism when he was in the middle of all this other stuff is just
right.
crazy. Shockley knew a lot about magnetism, but that was not what he should have been doing when this whole empire was falling apart.
Dr. Jones, could you hold on for one moment? I need to switch phones because this one's running out of juice. It'll just take me a second. Hello, Dr. Jones?
Yep.
Oh, thank goodness that worked. So it's not always clear that it's going to. Let's see. Well, now I recall the question that I had on my mind before the phone took it away, which was, in terms of that compartmentalization, was the reporting structure of the laboratory and sort of the communication structure sort of hub and spoke, with Shockley at the center and sort of everyone reporting right into him and communication being largely individual between Shockley and whomever?
Yeah, to a very large extent.
Okay.
And I think it changed. I think in later times, I think it changed, because I think Smoot Horsley was put into a more... I mean, Smoot Horsley was nominally the second in command.
Mm-hmm.
But that was only that was only in title.
I see.
So, I mean, the two senior officers, if you will, were Smoot Horsley and Knappick.
Mm-hmm.
So Knappick was sort of, administrative CEO or whatever.
Okay.
Was the charge of sort of administration and so on. And Horsley was nominally everybody's boss, but that was not in fact.
Horsley is somewhat of an enigma to me. In talking to any number of people, his name comes up, but very few people have a recollection of the nature of his contribution or what he was doing or where he came from and where he went. Do you have any insight?
I once did a web search on this, and I found absolutely, well, because you get the Smoot Horsley tariff, but
right,
and he was a relative of the Smoot in the Smoot Horsley tariff.
Okay.
No, he's a great mystery. Why he was there in the first place? As I mentioned to you when I first went there. He was, here he's nominally the senior guy, and I would go to him and sort of say, what do you think about this? Well, Chris was zip feedback. He would smile and look rather important, but that was not. I think I would not want to be, put into the history books negative comments on Smoot Horsley, because in many respects I have no idea why he was there. But I think your comment is a safe one, that he's very mysterious. I don't think anybody knew about him, and I don't know where he went. And to be honest, I have no idea where he came. I think he came from some military testing laboratory or something. He may have come to Shockley's connection Shockley was very much involved in proximity fuse development. And Smoot Horsley may have come through that path. I don't know.
One time I even wondered if, because I know Shockley had done work and had connections to sort of the intelligence community, and I at a time wondered if maybe Horsley went into that.
Yeah, well,
that would explain the.
He actually looked like a guy who would be an FBI. At any rate, I really would not like anything in the historic record.
Okay.
Because I really don't know. I mean, he's an enigma. I think you said it very well.
Okay.
And since I know nothing, I don't think it's nice.
Right. Gotcha. Well, I thought that maybe. Perhaps then we might talk about just your impressions of and experiences of what some of the other people in the laboratory were doing during your tenure there. We've talked about people like Sheldon Roberts. We talked about the informal seminar that you and Jay Last and Gordon Moore held, but perhaps we could just talk about some of the other figures and your impressions of what they were working on, the contributions that they were making. Is that all right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean,
yeah,
I certainly they're all people that I have. Well, not all people, but the ones you've mentioned are people I have respect for, considerable respect for.
Mm-hmm.
But I really was not aware very much of what they were doing, as again it was compartmentalized. Even Jay Last, who we were pretty close, but on the other hand, I'm not really sure what he was doing. I don't think he knew what I was doing. So, in a way, Shockley was very successful in making that isolation. Part of this also was the fact that we were all under tremendous stress. It was a very stressful environment, even before all the breakup stuff.
Yeah.
And I was aware of Noyce's things. I mean, the one interesting thing, which I think came out in Berlin's book, was the fact that Noyce did invent the tunnel diode,
mm-hmm.
and I think I was the guy who signed his lab book on that one. And I mean, Noyce was a very smart guy, and but he's also one of the great enigmas. I mean, I think Leslie Berlin has said that everybody who was interviewed about Bob Noyce say they don't know him, and we all knew him as smart, a very smart guy. I'm not even sure I knew what he was doing. I knew he was working on some kind of lithography, but I didn't know what that was for about. So it was very, right. it was a very remote environment in that regard.
Well,
I think in some respects that was one of the reasons that I felt I had to get out of there, because other than the Shockley, who was of course extremely smart and a very provocative guy to deal with. I mean, that was a very rich experience.
Yes.
But in some sense, I think that for me that was most valuable when it was the earlier thing before the thing got complicated, because
right.
the earlier thing I was dealing with Shockley all the time, and so it was tense, but very challenging, and you know, in a good sort of scientific way.
Yes.
As he got deeper and deeper mired in various things, it became clear that I wasn't even having that scientific stimulation. I mean, one of the people who, you know, historically that you haven't mentioned is John Hernie, who
yeah.
I think pretty clearly. I mean, you must have talked to Jay Last about him.
Because, yes.
They were actually quite close later on. But John Hernie, when I was there, Shockley was beating him apart. I mean, he was a brilliant guy, but Shockley was beating him up. But John Hernie is a very smart guy and certainly made a tremendous impact on semiconductor technology.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I'm not helping you very much here, but, you know, I can talk about people's personalities, but I really can't talk about their work.
Well, one thing that I definitely do want to ask you is, we talked about how the diffusion technology was really a centerpiece of his conception, of Shockley's conception for the future of the technology and for his operation.
Correct.
And is it correct that, you know, Gordon Moore was really focused on that diffusion work during the time that you were there?
Well, a lot of people were.
I mean, yeah.
Sheldon Roberts was working on that extensively.
Yeah.
And John Hernie, we're talking about a time before computers, and what John Hernie did, and sort of demeaning, but of course terribly useful. He was a theorist, and so he went off someplace and would calculate diffusion profiles for multi-diffused elements.
Right.
And so John Hernie was really worked through all of the theoretical models of diffusion, and then there were a variety of people who were doing the diffusions and building diffusion furnaces and doing that sort of technique, and then all the business of characterizing the diffused materials. I mean, the standard characterization in those days was to build a, it was to grind the things into a wedge-shaped element, and then to do scanning of the device structure,
mm-hmm.
and from that to find out how successful the models were. So there was a lot of that sort of core developing that technology very precisely, and I was aware that Sheldon was doing it. I was aware that Gordon Moore was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But above all, I was most conscious of the fact that John Hardy was doing all the theoretical stuff.
Okay.
But it was a core element. I mean, in fact, even in the proximity in the putty factory, the diffusion stuff was sort of in the middle of the room, as I recall it.
Okay. I was just wondering if there was any connection between, you know, later in the story, after your departure, and with that, as the coalescence of that group of dissatisfied folks, Gordon Moore took on a sort of spokesman role for that group with their discussions with Arnold Beckman, and I was just wondering if there was any connection between, you know, him being working on diffusion, which was kind of at the center of things, and maybe that.
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's,
yeah,
it's, you know,
just personality.
You probably know he's a very, I think the modern word centered is the, he's a very centered personality, and probably people trusted him.
Yeah,
because I don't think he's ever done anything dishonest. I mean, in my knowledge, has ever had any violation of integrity. And,
right.
And I think that comes through when people talk to him. And but yeah, I think he's a very centered individual. So I think that if people are going to trust somebody, I think your first choice would be him.
Right. Did you follow at all the fate of your crystal grower or of Shockley Semiconductor closely after you had gone to Harvard, or was that...
Not much, no.
Yeah.
I mean, Jay Last and I corresponded, and I was aware of various, what have become famous incidents, and the TAC incidents.
Right.
So I was aware of that as an ongoing story, I was aware when they went off, and even, you know, some thoughts about, you know, joining them and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
I was where I wanted to be at that point.
Right.
And I, after Fairchild was sort of in operation, I remember taking one trip out there to sort of, you know, renew old times with friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I had really gone in a different direction. So I really didn't have much contact with any of these people over the years. Noyce once was on the visiting committee of my department at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't work out very well for a variety of complicated reasons. And I mean, I was hoping he'd get some money to Harvard, but that didn't work. I really did lose track. In fact, it's only through sort of Leslie Berlin's thing that I've come back in contact with some of these people.
Hmm. Well, that's
particularly
good.
Julie Blank and Jay.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would just have then one last topic. Is to discuss perhaps how your experience in participating in this early unfolding of semiconductor technology and the semiconductor industry, what effects that has had on the shape of your subsequent research career at Harvard. Is there a connection between the two, or
now. Mm-hmm. I mean, not in any substantive connection. I certainly, I view the Shockley experience as more of a laboratory in human behavior. no, I mean that quite seriously.
Yeah.
Because it was a hyper-stress environment, and I think I learned a lot of lessons about how people perform in hyper-stress environments.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly learned how not to manage people. I mean, as I mentioned before, I think the Shockley is sort of a reservoir of how to do it wrong. And so I think I would say lessons that I took away from the thing tended to be things about human behavior and about. I think I grew up there. I mean, I was a kid from East Oakland, and I didn't have much experience in life, and except on the streets, this was a very mind expanding experience in a whole bunch of dimensions, and so I think I draw more from this. I really went back to resonance and magnetic oriented problems when I went to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Partly that was because I went there really not to work with, but because I was inspired by Van Vleck.
And right.
Van Vleck was a very instrumental character at Harvard. He founded the department that I'm in, and this is a department which is founded on the idea that applied physics is important, and I always believed that, and so it was largely sort of returning to the magnetism and Van Vleck's.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a graduate student, I had done a whole series of seminars on some of the work of Van Vleck on magnetic resonance oriented subjects, and he certainly is one of the most brilliant. Well, I mean, in a way, I think I had an interesting experience because I here in a juxtaposition of a few years, I worked with two of the most brilliant scientists in American history,
right.
Van Vleck and Shockley, and the contrast for sure. And I think I prefer the Van Vleck. Interesting. But my life got very busy at Harvard, and so I really didn't look back much at the Shockley experience. One of my close cronies at Harvard, we team taught a course which is largely a course in design, but it's a course in which we try to talk about how the world works and how you function in the world as a scientist and engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to have one of his major routines was to make fun of me as the only guy in this Shockley enterprise who didn't become a multimillionaire, and that the students shouldn't listen to me because it was the wrong lesson in life. So I think, you know, those are the kind of crazy messages that came across. I think one of the things which was disturbing is that I left Shockley in good odor. I mean, for a year afterwards, when he came by Cambridge, we'd have dinner together and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he eventually viewed me as a traitor too. So that was disturbing.
After
a couple of years had gone by.
Because
in some ways, I think. I think I'm only mentioned once in Leslie Berlin's book, but it's a peculiar thing. It said, and then Jones left. And in some ways, it did start going downhill rather rapidly after I left. I mean, obviously, I had nothing to do with that, but in some ways, I think in Shockley's mind, it may have played some role.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the last time I saw him, he was very cool, and I had heard from other people that he had said,
Oh.
Which I found disturbing, because one of the things that I had tried to leave there, not to have him fearing that I was going to reveal the secrets to anybody. And I was approached by quite a number of people at that time to kind of work for them. There was a sense that Shockley was doing wondrous things, and the idea of hiring somebody who had been on the inside was attractive to a lot of
other semiconductor manufacturers.
Exactly.
Oh.
And but I would never. I mean, as I said, Shockley was very fair to me, and that would be the last thing in the world I'd ever think about.
Would you care to mention who any of the who they were? No.
No.
Fair enough.
But, I mean, I think there was a general feeling that either Shockley was doing something very special, or it was crazy. I mean,
right.
I mean, I think there was an aura about the Shockley thing out in the semiconductor industry, and I think the opinions varied between those two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, there were people who had less in-house talent who would be interested in sort of. Building on that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, that would have, because I think, again, I go back to the fact is that there, Fairchild is positive proof that Shockley was on the right track.
That's exactly right.
And so, you know, there was, value in what was going on there. It's just that it, as you've mentioned, the ambivalence of goal was just the thing that killed it.
I know that across your work in applied physics at Harvard, you've electronics has been a recurring presence. You know, the relationship of the work you're doing to electronics, or new.
Sorry, I taught electronics for years.
Yeah. I guess the last query I would have would be, you know, have you been surprised by the unfolding of semiconductor electronics?
Oh yes. Oh,
and if you could talk about that a little bit.
I mean, why was it here? I was at the at least one of the birthing places, and. And in some ways, I have not built that into anything. So I could say, you know, gee, too bad. I should have stayed in semiconductors. And but you know, I can honestly say when I got out of the Shockley experience, it was such a relief.
Yeah.
In personal terms, because it, as I tried to convey, it was a very hot house. It's a very high intensity experience, and I was certainly did not want to get myself involved in a kind of lower level. I would not. excuse me. I think the guys who went through the Fairchild experience are very courageous, and I don't think I would have had the courage to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a much different person than that. I'm kind of a passive person.
Mm-hmm.
And to go through that kind of stinging thing is just it doesn't fit me.
Right.
And I certainly would be richer, but.
Well.
I'm perfectly happy the way that went.
I guess.
But I do enjoy electronics very much. I mean,
right.
For years and so on. But I also enjoy optics. I mean, I've probably put more time in teaching and doing optics.
Right.
And magnetism. I mean, I worked probably 20 years in various subjects of magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
I did make a positive effort to leave magnetism a few years ago, because it got to the point whenever a paper came out of magnetism, I sort of knew what was in the paper before I read it. So, you know, you now that's not true. I mean, in later times, magnetism has boomed again, and so there have been some more recent exciting developments in magnetism. But there was a point where magnetism was a little slow, and and optics was much more exciting at that point. So right. I did sort of visibly move over into optics. But I really view my primary love in this world is electromagnetic theory.
Mm-hmm.
Which of course encompasses both, and in some ways that in almost the history of these things that is almost orthogonal to semiconductors, not completely, but it's been almost orthogonal to semiconductors, and which I think is an interesting story because while Shockley was while he was director of physical research at Bell Labs, there was no work in magnetic resonance at Bell Labs because Shockley thought that magnetic resonance was of no world value. And in fact, the first person hired in magnetic resonance at Bell Labs was, I mentioned earlier, an office mate of mine at Berkeley, George Fair.
Okay.
And he first went to Bell Labs after Shockley had left there, because other people had said, gee, Bell Labs really got to get magnetic resonance. Of course, if that had not happened, Bell Labs would have known the role in masers and
right.
probably lasers. I mean, Shockley was a genius, but he was a short-sighted genius. and I think that's the field that I really have enjoyed more than semiconductors.
Right.
I mean, semiconductors is an incredible story.
Well then, I think that exhausts the questions that I had sketched out to hopefully ask you. I guess I might ask if just there's... Can you think of... anything large that I've overlooked, or is there anything that you would like to add that I could give you the opportunity to do so?
No, I mean I think you know obviously crystal growth has played a huge role in the technology of semiconductor technology. I think it sort of though addresses the point that I think was the tremendous mistake of the crystal grower that is the subject of this conversation.
Yes.
Namely, it went by increments. I mean, you know, people kept making larger and larger boules, and the technology sort of built up slowly. Because you can't just jump in. I mean, it's just technology is too complicated, too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I learned. I mean, I should have been much more resistant when Shockley first proposed building this thing. But I certainly didn't have the Shockley's a pretty strong personality.
Sure.
I really didn't stand up to him on this, as most people didn't stand up to Shockley on much.
Mm-hmm.
But I sure know now that you don't make those kind of... I mean, you asked what I learned about...
Yes.
I think I learned that you make things by tiny steps if you're going to make anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think where crystal growing has gone in the semiconductor industry is an example of that. I mean, I think, you know, you master the technique at each level and get it right.
I see. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's, as I say, I think that's probably the most enduring lesson I learned out of the Shockley thing,
mm-hmm.
the scientific side. The only thing I would reiterate and it's almost a quest that I believe in is that I as a historian I would sort of put you onto that track is that I do think that this whole diffuse based technology was a starting point. Mm-hmm. Of what I call the planar metaphor, was a starting point for a whole host of technical issues. And if Shockley's remembered for anything, and if it is, if it's true, as I'm saying, that he and Maury Tannenbaum were the first to articulate this, I think it's gotten under representation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have not researched this, and I would have a hard time defending this thesis, but I think as a question in the history of science and technology, I think it's an important one.
Yeah, it's I mean, certainly one hears people talking about the lithography approach, mm-hmm. it kind of in that manner, mm-hmm. as something that's become, let's say, more of a generally applicable approach for creating structure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a very intriguing idea about the diffusion. That, you know,
but I think it's more than that. I think it's with Shockley's dictum that natural processes had to be your guidance as you went to tiny things.
Right.
You had to find the appropriate natural process to do that.
Right.
And in that context, the plane, I mean, starting from a plane, is really what governs your whole thinking, because it is the plane which gives you a standard reference that you can do. I mean, photolithography without a plane is dead in the water.
Right.
Diffusion is dead in the water.
Right.
All kinds of ion implantation is dead in the water. Etching is dead in the water. So
mm-hmm.
everything depends upon having a well-established plane to start the structure, and that you use natural processes. I mean, all of the things we just mentioned are all natural processes, that you don't have some kind of big scraper that's going to accomplish this.
Right.
And I think, but I, as I say, I really have not been able to validate this as a proposition. I do think that the Shockley notion here, which certainly became the dominant metaphor for integrated circuits and mm-hmm. everything else, I think that Shockley was the first one to go down that road.
Yeah, it's a very intriguing concept. And thank you for sharing it with me. I'll have to think about it more and look into it.
I said, when I gave the same speech to Jay Last, he looked at me and said, that probably is true, but I don't think he was impressed.
Well, it is just... it's just simply the case that I had not thought about it in those terms before. But I think I do understand what that it's much more than talking about a technology that's being, you know, sort of a general purpose technology, but more of a technological mode, if you will.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, where I've been, you know, in more recent years relating to this thing is the whole integrated optics kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody would even have a second thought about the fact that that's where you go. I mean, that, you know, sure. I mean, this is this well-developed notion in coming out of semiconductor technology, and you just carry it over and so on. But. Where did that come from?
Yeah,
and I think the start is in the diffuse space structures.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only way one could get at that is to probe more the invention of the diffuse based device.
And yeah.
I don't know that history. I mean, that's deep in the labs, I think one would have to look there to see if they had some kind of model to call on that they said, oh, why don't we do this way? It's, you know, it could be that there is some idea, but I think once you have that metaphor in your technical palette,
yeah,
I think in many respects, I think the rest of integrated circuitry follows. You're doubtless aware, there's a lot of controversy of how much noise had to do with the development of the integrated circuit and so on. I think is somewhat a separate. I mean, I think that's somewhat a red herring, because my experience. I mean, you asked about what other people were doing. It when I can remember luncheons at Shockley Semiconductor when people are sitting around having a hamburger and a beer and talking about making a transistor and then saying, gee, we could actually put a resistor on this thing. And,
yeah.
You know, we could put everybody thinking in terms of a sort of classic p-junction type circuit.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have a capacitor and you had to have a resistor, and so you say, well, you know, you could really make a resistor on there and so on, which is, you know, that's the integrated circuit evolving.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, once you had the notion of a planar surface sitting there and the techniques to form that surface,
mm-hmm.
it's almost kind of obvious that you put down multiple devices and go on. If you could do it, I mean, you know, obviously the materials thing is
central.
I mean, you started out here for the materials thing. Obviously, none of this works without a good material.
Yeah.
The whole lesson of semiconductors is that you got to have good stuff. We really haven't talked that much about it, I worked a lot in the field of ferroelectrics.
Yes.
And ferroelectrics is an interesting, the ferroelectrics has always been a field which excites people, but it, by and large, there have been a few positive things, but by and large, it's a dead end because the material's no good.
Hmm.
You never had really good ferroelectric materials. And in contrast to silicon and silicon dioxide, I mean, God, what a dream material. The core of anything we do is how good the material is. I had a group that was growing ferroelectric materials for some time and so forth, but it's just a terribly hard problem.
Right.
In contrast to what silicon has become, and that is the cutting point of technology, is good materials work. And it's why, in some ways, the 3.5s obviously have some great successes, but also why they're always sort of limping behind silicon.
Because of the amount of materials.
Just too hard.
Yeah.
Obviously there are some great 3.5 devices and
mm-hmm.
and so on, but silicon still reigns and always will, I think. The story of why one tries so hard to make silicon diodes. It's, a lot of us have broken our axe on that one.
Right.
And why is it? Because silicon's so good and gallium arsenide's so tough. and so the material thing really is, as you're well aware, is defines the agenda.
Yeah, that's true. So it does sound that to just connect it back once again to the to the crystal grower episode at Shockley, you know, it seems like Shockley's willingness, or in fact his push to, you know, start this project immediately, to hold it as a very closely guarded trade secret, to invest the space, the expense, the staff effort. I mean, that really does seem to express the centrality there of the materials issue.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, Shockley was so keenly aware of, you know, how the purification of germanium had figured in the start of the whole business, and nothing was possible until we had good germanium. He was acutely aware of that, and at the time that this lab started, silicon was not a great material.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would criticize the fact that Shockley wanted to solve this problem. I think what I criticize is the approach rather than solving a lot of complex problems. I mean, I would contrast this, for example, in terms of materials development. Of course, it's a different scale of a thing, but in the early days of lasers,
mm-hmm.
People would make various 3-5 combinations to make lasers, but they would instantaneously burn out. So you'd have a nice lasing device which would last, a microsecond or something.
Okay.
A second anyway. At Bell Labs, people said, gee, we have to understand this, because there were so-called black spots. I mean, you'd watch one of these things and you'd suddenly see a black spot appearing at the junction, and it would migrate and the device would go away.
Huh.
In some ways, semiconductor diodes were an interesting curiosity, but they were by no means something that anybody could bank on. But at Bell Labs, people said, gee, we got to understand this problem, and they started the whole process of epitaxial growth, layer by layer growth of materials.
Right.
Until they understood what the problems were in terms of purity and of course eventually got devices that we now take for granted.
Right.
Once they learned what the defect structures were, then people could go back and get simpler, because obviously various kinds of beam epitaxies are very expensive and very complex structures. So once one understood what the defects were, one could go back to simpler methods and refine them. But it really took a 10-year effort to get the materials right.
Mm-hmm.
And now we take it for granted, all that stuff. But it was a triumph of material science to get that stuff right. And again, I think an unappreciated one. I mean, we sort of don't realize that had to go on before one could make these devices any good.
Right.
And of course, that has revolutionized technology.
Sure. And you would say the contrast approach there was very much...
to realize that, number one, it was a hard and difficult problem.
Right.
And you had to find careful means to climb a mountain.
Okay.
And I think eventually molecular epitaxy became that technique, which is not a simple technique by any stretch, but it was directed at solving problems in a systematic way,
right.
Whereas what we were doing was not systematic.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much for spending so much time with me on the telephone today.
Okay, I hope it's useful.
It's very useful. It's...
And the Shockley story is a complicated one. Probably the most complicated scientist. I won't say the most complicated, but certainly one of the more complicated over time.
Very much so.
But I think he did make some contributions.
I think that's unquestionable. What I will do is then have our conversation transcribed. That will take 2 weeks, perhaps a little bit longer, depending on the transcriptionist's backlog. And then we will do that initial editing procedure, and I will send it out to you for your review. And
I think the only thing in the discussion, which I think I would like to edit out, is anything about this Wood Horsley thing, because I don't know whether his family or anything would be
inclined
to read these things.
That's true. Perhaps we could just keep his enigmatic status.
Oh, I don't mind being enigmatic. I wouldn't want to make any odious comparisons.
Sure.
I don't think I dissed anybody else.
I don't think so, no. So, well, then I'll just be back in touch with you soon as we have this transcribed.
Great.
Well, thanks again so very much.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.